It was a dark and cold night in the deserts of Arizona in December 2021, when Lama Christy McNally, a woman who had been declared a goddess by a small group of Tibetan Buddhists, climbed up onto a stage to address her family in this crowded temple building that was recently built to support what she saw as one of the most important meditative feats that had ever happened in America. A lot of the people in the audience didn't really know very much about Tibetan Buddhism. I mean, maybe they've heard of the Dalai Lama. They're aware that meditation might have some particular health benefits. Maybe there's some spiritual things that can come out of it. But Lama Christy McNally had made this vow that she and the other about 50 retreatants who she would lead in total silence for 3 years, almost like they were being shot out into space and having no real contact with the rest of the world. She had to explain to these people, her friends, former lovers, and family, why she would want to do this in the first place. Some of them had donated money to the cause, and she needed to convince these assembled people that this trip into silence and into her own mind was going to be worth it and that the world would become a better place because of it. This is an important scene in my book, The Enlightenment Trap, which I re-released this year. And I wanted to talk about the mindset that she got into and apply it to another concept which is incredibly powerful right now in the scientific speaking world, which I'll get into in just a second. Because to explain why she was doing this incredible and yet a little crazy feat, she had to dip into the existing literature that everyone would recognize. And she chose a movie that you probably have seen. It's a pretty good movie. It's called The Matrix. And she argued that what she was doing in this meditation was accessing the simulation that we all live in so that she could control the hidden strings that create the universe. She was going to become Neo. And fortunately, her speech was recorded and transcribed and circulated on the internet briefly. I was able to capture that transcript, and I'm going to read to you her words before she descended into nothingness. These are her words. "I was trying to figure out how I'm going to tell you about emptiness. That's pretty close, the movie, The Matrix. We were actually really amazed that they made a movie about us. That's what we are trying to do. All the ancient texts that we have been studying for the past 6 years have been telling us how our world is not what it seems, how everything around us in our reality is not really out there in the way that we think it is. It's coming from somewhere else. It's coming from seeds inside of our own hearts. It's like a virtual reality that is being projected out, but it's not some Uber computer that's projecting it. It is us. We are the ones projecting our reality. And there are a lot of amazing implications from that. It means that you could do what Neo did. Then anything in the world that you don't like, you could just reach inside your own heart and change a few things, and then the world would change. And we are here in the 3-year retreat to see if we can do that." And that was her stated goal. And that was the type of Buddhism which was being taught repeatedly at Diamond Mountain University. But it's also a thought that's, I mean, it's honestly one that a lot of Americans like. And who doesn't want to bend spoons with their mind? Who doesn't want to be able to learn to fly like a superhero? Who doesn't want to save the world? And what if changing your perspective didn't only, you know, result in madness, your own insanity, but actually changed physical reality. Well, is that possible or is that a fantasy? That was what their experiment set out to discover. Now, the idea is a lot older than Lama Christy McNally, of course. It goes back at least all the way to a guy named Dolpopa in Tibet in the 1300s, and it's probably even older than that, to be honest. But Dolpopa was one of the main proponents of something that we now call mind-only Buddhism, which is that the mind is what creates reality. You know, since you don't really know what someone else is thinking or sensing, or even if they see the same color blue that you do, well, maybe everything comes only from your mind. And that was what Dolpopa taught back in the 1300s. And I talked about this in episode 11 of this podcast, which was titled The Monk Who Fucked Everything, A Brief History of Print Capital from Tibet to Modern America. And it's, you know, it's a really fun ride, and I suggest you listen to that after you listen to me right now. But as, you know, Christy McNally noted in her speech, you know, they would be essentially Neo in the Matrix. They would find the tools that are locked in their minds to change the way they see reality. And by doing that, I mean, they would end war. They would end dying. They could, you know, fix just about anything should they choose to. And, you know, who wouldn't want something like that? Well, of course, if you've read my book, you know that things, well, they don't go exactly all that well for Lama Christy. You know, there's a sex scandal. At one point, she stabs her lover with a knife during an intensive tantric meditation. And this cascades into her getting kicked out of her leadership position. And eventually, what happens is she's on a mountaintop and her husband is dying of dysentery because they made some poor decisions. And she has this option that she can use her magical powers that she had cultivated for at that point several years in the desert, and she could heal her husband, or she could make a phone call to search and rescue and save his life. And at that moment, you know, it wasn't just his life that was on the line. It was their very souls. Her version of mind-only Buddhism would say that death, well, that's not the real problem. The problem is whether or not you can truly commit your mind to forging reality. I won't tell you everything that happened because I do want you to go read The Enlightenment Trap or even listen to it as an audiobook, whatever is more convenient for you. But I will tell you this. As far as we know, she never became Neo in the Matrix. But this question about whether or not we live in a simulation, well, it's an incredibly strong idea that exists in the world that we live in, or the simulation that we live in right now. I mean, both Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg are betting, well, yes, it's more likely than not that what you see and what you experience is not real in the sense that you, well, we want it to be, that it's connected to the real world of, like, of wood and flesh and bone, but actually it's the ones and zeros in computer code. This idea isn't verified experimentally, but actually descends out of this law, a computer law called Moore's Law, that says that as time progresses, the number of transistors in the world will explode exponentially, and you can make smaller and smaller and smaller transistors, which means that computing power increases every year by exponential levels, so that what you think is computing power now is just a piffle of what it will be in a few years. And we have seen that Moore's Law has held very, very well since the beginnings of transistors. We are in exponential growth of computer power. And that's where this is, the idea is founded on. Because it also suggests that if, you know, you live in a world, or if the people who created computers ever bothered even a few times to create a computer game like The Sims, or, you know, some desire to run simulations of the world for whatever reason they might want to, well, then as many real worlds that we live in might actually exist on computer hard drives. Because, of course, as simulations get better, they will imitate reality more and more and more. And just like you can load a copy of The Sims on your computer, or a game like Civilization on your computer, you know, right now, there's also millions of other computers that could be running that same simulation. So from a mathematical perspective, once you get to a point where computing power is basically infinite, that means almost inevitably, if there's only one real reality out there and there's millions or maybe even infinite number of simulations, well, then mathematically it just makes sense that, yeah, of course we live in a simulation. Of course we're on someone else's desktop. Of course, this does depend heavily on the concept that Moore's law is actually a law and not just some sort of historical happenstance. I mean, another way to examine that question is, well, are transistors doubling at the same rate that they had doubled in the past? And there's some indication that we're about as small as is physically possible. You know, once your transistor gates are the size of an atom, how much smaller can you really go? Well, there are some people who suggest that it goes into quantum computing. And if that is true, well, maybe there's no limit. I mean, we'll see. I don't know if Moore's law is actually a law that will continue forever. If it is, well, that simulation theory makes some sense. But if it isn't, well, there's a good reason to think that maybe we're not in that type of simulation. I've also wondered, of course, that if you're running a simulation and your simulation gets to the point where your simulations run their own simulations, it sort of becomes like that movie Inception where the dream is dreaming inside of a dream inside of a dream. Could a simulation simulate another universe? And if you could that underlying computer code, that underlying hardware, manage the simulation within a simulation? These are speculative in the extreme questions, but they are out there and they make Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg think that, yeah, there's a good chance of it. And that's not the only type of simulation that we might live in. Another idea put forth by physicists is that perhaps, according to the law of entropy, which suggests that molecules and particles can assemble themselves into random and complex configurations just over the course of time, that perhaps, you know, after the universe has expanded and then died, after the heat death of the universe, that vacuum can actually create random particulate matter. And the idea of a Boltzmann's brain is that a human brain, trillions of years in the future, appeared out of the ether and experienced everything you're experiencing right now. It formed the neurons and the electrical signals out of vacuum. And we only exist for a fraction of a second before that matter dissipates. But in that moment, well, that's this moment that you're experiencing right now. Mathematically, and according to the laws of entropy, there are infinite Boltzmann's brains, many more Boltzmann's brains than there are actual material universes. Most physicists think that this idea is insanity, but recently, when you run the math, well, it's actually more likely that you are a Boltzmann's brain than a real person. But it's pretty disconcerting. And as an act of faith, and maybe faith alone, I don't think that we are Boltzmann's brains. And I think that there are some problems with the Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk simulation computer theory. But I am here to tell you, 15 minutes into this podcast, that yes, in fact, there is verifiable proof that we do live in a simulation. And it's not exactly what you think, but it is amazing. But before I get to that, it's a word from our sponsors, which is, of course, a word from me and you. Because this podcast, I never intend for it to run advertisements. I want your listening experience to be clean and clear, and you'd hear my voice, and that would be it. It's just me and you right here. And there are two ways that I would like you to support my podcast. And the first is entirely free, and you have the ability to do it right now by just wiggling your fingers. And it's that I would love you to put a 5-star review on whatever podcast app thing that you're using and listening on. And if you do that, I will read your 5-star review here on this channel. And you can write whatever you want. It can be funny. In fact, I sort of think it would be fun if you could be funny, because it makes the copy a little more interesting. Don't be obscene, of course. Don't, you dirty people, don't you be obscene. But I'm going to read you two comments of people who did that from the last episode that I put out. This one is from Alexandra. I haven't known much about most of the topics prior to listening, but Scott's delivery is so compelling, it puts me right into all of the podcasts. The episodes have taught me a lot, as well as left me a lot to consider, which is such an awesome thing to say. Thank you so much, Alexandra, because that's the whole reason why I'm doing this. I'm trying to connect to you. Another reader wrote, this one from Sweden. I believe you would pronounce this name Antlion. I love Scott Carney's writing, and I'm so glad that he's jumped into the podcast pool. I just hope he doesn't stop writing books. Well, Antlion, me too. I do love writing books. And in fact, I'm working on one right now, which I will touch on very soon in this podcast, because it all connects to that whole simulation stuff I'm talking about. But there's another way. You know, once you've wiggled your fingers and you've written something witty in that 5-star column, another thing you can consider is joining a community of committed folks on Patreon. And there's a link down below where, you know, you will be paying a slight amount of money, about 10 bucks a month, but you'll get input into future episodes as I consider and put them out and see these shows come together, get early access. You'll get it days before anyone else. And you can even talk to me in a private Discord server that I have for patrons. You want to be part of this awesome thing, this journalism, these investigations as they happen? Come and join my Patreon. There's a link down below in the show notes. I also put, like, you know, polls on Spotify, and sometimes I put questions on Spotify. You can also weigh in there for all that stuff. All right, well, that's my 3 minutes of, you know, self-promotion here. Thank you for listening. And let's get back into the question of simulations. Now, if you've read my book, The Wedge, I've talked about some of the underlying physiology on how we experience the world, right? Your brain is stuck inside the flesh sac of your body. And the only way your brain knows anything about the outside world is through your sensory system, through your central nervous system and your peripheral nerves. If you touch the brain, well, the brain doesn't feel anything. The brain has no nerves of its own. Instead, it detects everything from the outside world, and it comes in. It has to travel. That data from the outside world has to travel through these conduits before the brain makes sense of everything that's around the body. Well, here's something that's super important to understand about how the brain reads the world, because it takes time for your nerves to transmit signals into that gray matter in your head. the brain's a little bit behind. It's not really interacting with the world in real time. And if you measure it, and you know, careful neuroscientists have measured it, it takes about a fifth of a second for your brain to experience reality, which means your brain is always, well, a little bit behind the things that are going on around it. Now, a fifth of a second, I mean, it's not a whole lot of time, but it is time, and a lot can happen in a fifth of a second. You know, you could get hit by a rock in a fifth of a second and never know that it was going to hit you. Only you would experience it in your brain after that rock has hit you. Car accidents, bullets, predators. A fifth of a second can be life and death. And over the course of human evolution, our brains, and animal brains as well, have come up with a really novel solution to the neural lag that we all live in. The brain takes all of the data that has been coming in all of the time and compiles it into a prediction of what will happen 1/5 of a second into the future. It runs a simulation on top of that raw data and fast forwards it. So you are actually living in this 1/5 of a second future that has been constructed entirely by your brain. This means if you take two people and you're able to devise a very special experiment that puts a stimulus into the world 1/5 of a second ahead of another person, and you carefully measure it, you could have entirely different experiences in that small gap because the prediction machines in our head just invented different data. This is what reality is for you. These words that I have recorded in the past are coming to you, and the audio waves are going through your headset or your car speakers, and all that takes time, and your brain is somehow compiling that information and finishing words that it's already heard, and then advancing that play track ahead so that you actually hear, you actually experience those words in real time, even though the signal hasn't yet reached you. Fortunately, as far as we can tell, those simulations are pretty closely matched to the real world. We're pretty good at taking the data that's out there and running forward that clock, you know, that infinitesimally small amount of time, which is really, really good. The simulation also builds emotions to navigate the world. And I wrote about that in The Wedge too, and how those emotions get formed and how these emotions are actually predictive mechanisms. The reason why we have emotions is to decide how we want to approach new stimuli from our past. I know that we think about emotions as feelings, but the reason why you have feelings is so that when you're walking down the street, you can decide whether or not that person is a threat or not a threat, or if that's your future girlfriend. You know, you have these associations from the past that help you make predictions about the future. That's what emotions are about. Another way that the brain makes simulations is, of course, this idea of a homunculus. If you want to Google up an image of a neuroscience homunculus into Google, what this is the way that the brain attaches its neurons to your peripheral nervous system. And the artist's interpretation of the homunculus is, well, it's sort of awesome. You know, you have more nerves in your fingers and your lips than anywhere else in your body. And your eyes are also very important, lots of nerves there as well. So the way the homunculus is constructed is it has really giant hands and genitals and feet and lips and eyeballs and ears. But other things like your elbows are represented as much smaller because there's fewer nerves there. That homunculus is the image that your mind receives, how it gets sensory data out of the world. It's super fascinating to look at and to sort of think about, well, if the brain is in this meat box of our body, well, what is the brain actually connected to? Well, it constructs that homunculus. And all of this leads to this book that I've been working on for about 6 months now. Actually, it was back in the summer of 2022 that I was hanging out with this breathwork trainer named Brian McKenzie, who's a buddy of mine, where we were talking about what sort of biohacking book should we work on? What's the thing that you do that makes you feel the best? And we sort of joked that, you know, we should write a book on napping because we both love those short sleeps at the end of the day. And well, I doubled down. I sort of went into this book on napping, and I've been doing a ton of reading and research on that short sleep that you might do in the middle of the day and how it restores you and why it restores you. And in the process of doing that research, I also ended up on this sort of rabbit hole of what dreams do to us and why we dream in the first place. This is going to be the subject of future podcasts, but just to give you a highlight, which will then connect back to this simulation question. You know, you have to ask the question, what are dreams made of? Why do you dream at all? You know, sure, we know we have them. We have those experiences in our head, but what are they actually? You know, there's a great book by this sleep scientist named Matthew Walker called Why We Sleep, which really gets into depth on sleep questions. But to sort of run this in a very condensed form, the reason why we dream is to create emotions. It's not to remember the content of dreams. Instead, what happens is throughout the day, you're collecting all of this sensory data. Most of it's not very important. I'm not going to remember why I put my glasses on the table at some exact moment in the day or what that particular glass of water tasted like. That information's not particularly important. However, important sensory data sort of makes this mark. It comes in at a high volume into your dream receptors. That's not a part of the brain. I'm just making that up. It's all stored in short-term memory. And what happens during dreaming is that you start discarding that data, you know, like the RAM in a computer. You start clearing out that data and then reducing the salient information into basically a compressed file, sort of like a zip file on your computer. That zip file is an emotion. Now, I gave some examples of how emotions are deployed in the brain and the wedge. You know, you have an experience, it creates a bond with your sensory data, and that emotion gets bonded to this sensory data, and that's sort of how we live in the world. But I didn't really answer in the wedge where emotions originally come from because it was a very complex question and I didn't quite have a handle on it, but I have a handle on it now. It happens in dreams. Your emotional basis, the way you feel about things, you know, you might have an emotional experience during a day in an immediate event, but that gets processed, refined, and stored as the gist of events as a dream. And then when you navigate the world, you navigate through emotions. You don't navigate like Spock in a land of rationality. You just sort of feel you should go left or right at this point. Oh, that person's good to talk to. Hey, this is fun. Hey, that's going to be interesting. Those are all emotions, and they form in dreams, which is why it's not all that important to remember your dreams. That dreaming is the read-write process of creating emotions, and you remember the emotions because they're in that sort of compressed format. And now, to get back to the simulation thing, if you think about consciousness, you know, you're always taking data from the outside world, and your brain is projecting that into the future. There's this relationship between the outside world and your brain's immediate activity. But if you wanted to ask the question, well, what is the truest form of consciousness? It's not when your brain is practicing the relay between the outside world and the inside world. The truest form of expression happens when you're dreaming, when the simulation of consciousness is running on its own, and it's creating the world that it lives in. It's creating that predictive model of emotions. That, those dreams are where consciousness exists in its purest state. I asked the neuroscientist, Adam Har Horowitz, who's at MIT, the question, why don't we remember our dreams? And, you know, he sort of looked at me with these funny and sleepy eyes. Actually, no, I don't know if he looked at me because I think it was over the phone, but I imagine he looked at me with his sleepy eyes. And he said to me, Scott, you're always dreaming. There's never a time that your brain is not processing the information of the world in the same way that we do when we're dreaming, because we live in that simulation, which isn't drawing on raw data from the outside world. It's drawing on the predictive models that our brain creates. Now, maybe you see where I'm going with this. This whole thing started with the question of, do we or do we not live in a simulation? Well, it's very clear that our brains create a simulation, and you are living in that right now. And I am living in my simulation, and everyone is living in a simulation of their own. But it's not one of those centralized simulations. It's not a simulation in the sense of we live in Sim City or the game Civilization or someone's computer program or a Boltzmann's brain or whatever Lama Christy McNally was trying to access when she was hoping to become Neo in the Matrix, some sort of ultimate truth that goes back at least to the Buddha. Well, I don't know if those simulations actually exist. I don't know if there is a true state of enlightenment that the Buddha only could absorb himself. But I can say that we do live in these decentralized simulations that come up out of our own neurons and that get ground like grist in the forge of our dreams, which is another reason why, well, you should take your sleep seriously, because your simulation gets a little wonky if you don't get the right amount of sleep. If you don't go through the REM and deep sleep stages in the correct order, well, things can go a little haywire and your simulation can go off and your emotions don't quite connect accurately to the outside world anymore. Get some sleep. Improve your simulation. Should that be the title of this podcast? Should I title it, Get Some Sleep, Improve Your Simulation? I probably won't. It'll probably be something along the lines, yes, we live in a simulation, because we need those clickbait titles. Can't get your followers if you don't have those clickbait titles. I hope these ideas, though, despite whatever, you know, the marketing side of podcasting, my least favorite side of podcasting, I hope these ideas are useful to you. I'd love you to share them with somebody, you know, personally. Say, hey, this Scott maniac, who has a microphone and lives in Denver, this Scott maniac had some cool ideas. I don't know if I agree with him or not, but what do you think? Friend, lover, wife, whatever, cousin? Tell him. Maybe there's something cool there. But also realize that when you talk to this person, that you're really talking to what their simulation is thinking about your simulation. Maybe they'll make you feel a little weird. Maybe it's just totally fine. Either way, stay tuned for the next episode of Scott Carney Investigates, because, well, I've been looking at my calendar schedule, and I have to say, I'm announcing something pretty damn big with my next episode, something that many of you have been waiting for a long time, and it's pretty important. And if you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. And if not, well, you have no idea what I'm talking about. Just imagine it. Your simulation will pop something out in about a week, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. I'm not going to give you the exact date because something has to be timed very carefully. But keep glued to this feed. And think about leaving that 5-star review with your comment. It had better be a witty comment. I want a really nice, witty, maybe a haiku. Why don't you write me a haiku? Because that would be fun down there in the comments. Thank you so much. From Pokey Bear LLC in Denver, Colorado, this was Scott Carney Investigates.